It's now 4 or 5 years later.
The child absolutely refuses to talk about it. Child learns what happens when you talk about these things. There is medical evidence of abuse. So this is not a false memory. This is not something that cannot be corroborated. But of course, the medical testimony will tell you there is abuse. It doesn't tell you who is doing the abuse. A therapist working with the child for over a year using non-suggestive techniques was unable to get any information from the child. Hypnosis was used. The child was relaxed. The child told the whole story. And the story, again, is confirmed by the medical evidence. Because the hypnosis is used, the child is now forever disqualified. Her testimony is inadmissible in court, and if she should seek to sue her father, she would be disqualified as a witness in that case also. I don't think that rule is fair, and I have argued against it and written against it. But then I wrote Trance on Trial to alert you to the fact that that child could then sue her therapist for using hypnosis. And if you have not given the patient an informed consent form that explains that under the law, if we use hypnosis and you discover any information which can be corroborated that could lead you to have a legitimate lawsuit against a third party, you will be disqualified from doing so because the hypnosis was used. And if you are using hypnosis or indeed working with memory at all, you also need another informed consent form. And it is now good clinical practice to let the patient know what the literature, in fact, does demonstrate about memory. Memory is malleable, and it is not historically accurate necessarily. Nobody has ever asked the false memory people how they remember their names, of course, or how they know what home to go to at the end of the day. So a certain part of memory must work. But there is no guarantee that any particular memory is accurate, no matter how much emotion is invested in a memory, no matter how much detail is in a memory, no matter how much impact the recovery of that memory has on an individual, it may still be inaccurate. That's true out of hypnosis, and it's true in hypnosis, and patients ought to know it. Because most of what has happened with there are two major kinds of false memory legal case. One is where the patient sues the therapist saying, you essentially talked me into believing that I was a certain kind of person, MPD, with satanic abuse and mind control programming and so forth, and I was really none of those. The other kind of case is where the patient goes out into the world, confronts the family, has a break with the family, accuses the family of incest or sexual abuse, and the family is now disrupted. It's the second kind of case that I'm talking about, where there is an outside the therapy room encounter. Good risk management suggests that you keep the therapy in the therapy room, and that any activity that the patient wants to take in the outside world is the patient's decision, not yours. You should not urge confrontation with outside people. You should make it clear that no charges or any actions should be brought against a third party without independent corroboration and probably without the advice of a lawyer. That the therapist works with material in the therapy room, whether it is historically accurate or not. Once that material goes outside of the therapy room, it should not be your responsibility. But it is your responsibility to let the patient know, first, that it isn't your responsibility what the patient does outside, and secondly, that the patient, before doing anything outside, should be aware of the fallibility of memory and should not act hastily on the fact that a memory has been recovered. All right, I've got to move on. Let's go talk about satanic cults and then mind control programming. The American public is not interested in hearing about the existence of satanic cults and mind control programming. Do satanic cults exist? Of course. There is no doubt about that, except in the minds of some people. But those people do not include the FBI. Because if one reads Ken Lanning's report,
which is not an FBI report but a personal report, the FBI certainly recognizes the existence of satanic cults. There are many books reporting on Satanism and satanic cults. The American Family Foundation, which is the foremost organization monitoring cult activity, has issued at least 2 reports on the existence of Satanism and found a variety of different kind of satanic practices that occur. The newspapers are filled with stories about satanic rituals and satanic cults and so forth. The fact of the reality of satanic cults does not mean that juries are necessarily going to want to hear it. It's not that they disbelieve it. It's that they choose not to hear it. And so in working with people who report satanic abuse, you have to be very careful. And here is where good note-taking is extremely important. There are 2 schools of thought about note-taking. One is, the less I say, the less they can pin on me. That is not the preferential view. Taking notes, you have been taught, is a way of doing good therapy. I tell you now, it serves another purpose. It serves as a legal defense. For you to accurately report in full detail what happens in therapy sessions may be the best defense you have. Because if the ideas of Satanism come from the patient and not from you, your note should reflect that. And your note should reflect that the patient kept going back to the issue of Satanism and kept insisting that the issue be talked about. And your note should demonstrate that this is not something that you have created in the mind of patient, but rather something that has been generated by the patient, and the patient's demeanor has indicated that he or she is not likely to get better or to hear other kinds of discussion unless that subject is covered. There is nothing that prohibits you from talking about these things, but make sure you document that this is not something that you are implanting. And the kinds of things that the patient is reporting should be reported in your notes as, the patient said this, the patient said that. And I responded, is there anything else you want to say? Do you have anything else to tell me? Or other non-suggestive forms of open-ended questions, so that you cannot be accused of leading or using undue suggestion. With mind control programming, the issue is a little more difficult, because while we can show the physical reality of Satanism, and by the way, let me make another comment about Satanism. The FBI report and Gail Goodman's independent research have demonstrated that there is no empirical proof of multi-generational international conspiracies of satanic organizations. And we have to assume that that's a fact. But that fact doesn't mean that there isn't international networks of trafficking in children for pedophiles. And indeed, in another one of those little stories buried in a back page, there was just an enormous arrest in Italy of a pedophile ring that was buying Chinese children and shipping them around the world. Those stories are, of course, ignored in part by the media. But what we are now learning is the kind of things that we have heard of as ritual abuse in a satanic context may actually be a form of international ritual abuse in a pedophile context. And the FBI has acknowledged the existence of international rings in trafficking in children. And so we're only starting to learn about these things. It is not your job to be a detective, but it is your job to be a good chronicler of the stories your patient tells you, and to have your notes reflect the fact that you are not creating, implanting, suggesting, or influencing these stories. With mind control programming, the problem becomes even more difficult. Is there mind control programming? Of course. Indeed, many of the false memory people, wrote some of the best works on mind control programming, and did it in the context of religious cults. I myself wrote the definitive version of the Central Intelligence Agency and U.S. Army's mind control programs that were secret programs that extended over a period of 25 to 30 years. I read somewhere between 12 and 20,000 pages of previously classified, secret, top secret, and eyes only documents to put that book together, the books of the mind manipulators, currently out of print. We can document that thousands of people, including mental patients, juveniles, and others, were unwitting victims in CIA mind control efforts. But these programs are largely unknown to the public. The idea of mind control programming has such an aura of science fiction about it that people do not like to hear it. And therefore, in your note-taking, you must again be very careful to make sure that you don't indicate any influence by you on the patient in reporting these kinds of events. Also, with satanic cults, with memories, with mind control programming, it is easy to lose sight of the ball. The ball is stabilizing the patient, making the patient able to function in the outside world. All of these other things are distractions at worst, or things that need to be discussed at best to be overcome in order to get to the real business at hand. A lot of the problem that has generated the lawsuits is that these areas have been found to be so intriguing that the actual treatment goals have been lost sight of, and instead the idea of investigating multinational trafficking in mind control programming and so forth had become the centerpiece of the therapy. And so as seductive as these things are, be careful that you don't lose sight of the treatment goals, and your notes are the best place for that information to be transcribed and to be available later. While we're talking about information and knowledge, there is no substitute for knowing the literature. And I think what has happened to therapists, and I've said this for many years, but I'll continue to say it, is that you were blindsided by a literature you never heard of, and which you are now expected to master. And your failure to know about that literature has been the basis of many, if not all, of these lawsuits. I personally have yet to see a lawsuit in this area, and I've seen a lot of them, where the literature on brainwashing, mind control, undue influence, police interrogation practices, and social influence and suggestibility have not been thrown at therapists. Generally, the only aspect of those literatures that you're exposed to are interviewing and techniques and the difference between closed and open questioning. But there is a rich and incredibly fascinating literature that you now must be aware of, not only on memory and the available ways in which memory may or may not be influenced, but on suggestion and suggestibility, on police interrogation practices, and on mind control and brainwashing. There was a case in New England where a therapist was being sued, and the deposition was a month away. The therapist called in desperation, asking for help. And I said, here's what you need to do, and gave a reading list to the therapist and names of people in her area who could train her in these literatures. The deposition occurred, and about an hour or two into the deposition, the lawyers took a break and went into the men's room. And in the men's room, they said, we're not going to get anywhere. She knows too much. She's too familiar with the literature. Her husband was in the men's room, and the lawyers didn't know it. And her husband was able to report this back to her. We had trained her in that month to be available for the literature, and they could not touch her on deposition. You now have to know that literature as well. And just as I wrote Trance on Trial to protect you from the lawsuits by the patients claiming malpractice, Dan Brown, Corey Hammett, and I wrote Memory, Trauma, Treatment, and the Law to bring together in one place all of the available literature on memory, brainwashing, police interrogation, and so forth, so you can at least see what that literature looks like. And the more familiar you become with it, the more you will be doing your own risk management without realizing it, because mistakes you would otherwise have made, you will no longer make. For example, Many of the people who deal in the area of mind control programming were in the early days lured into the notion that there are certain kinds of programs that exist, certain kinds of programming, certain people who are doing the programming, and so forth. Those of us who work in the area of mind control and brainwashing know that almost everything we hear is wrong. The amount of disinformation is so overwhelming that we believe nothing until we can independently corroborate it. Therapists have the opposite kind of training. While you may not believe everything your patient says, it is good therapeutic practice to give the patient the encouragement that you do believe. And a good deal of what patients report has some basis in fact, although it may be highly exaggerated. In the area of mind control, people jumped in, believed everything they heard immediately, and paid no attention to the specialists who could have warned them that most of what people disseminate as brainwashing theories and ideas simply are not true. And unless programs, policies, techniques, government programs, and so forth have been corroborated as actually having occurred, there is no reason to believe them. So, for example, MK Ultra was a program of the Central Intelligence Agency, which had 149 sub-projects on every avenue of mind and behavior control. We know that was a real project, and we know what the sub-projects under it are. But there are many names that have been circulated of other projects, and they cannot be verified. And if they cannot be verified, and you can't prove them, your belief in them will hurt you in a court of law and also in doing good therapy. And so be aware that you will be called into question about the literatures on mind control, brainwashing, and particularly police interrogation. Because the way police talk people into false confessions is the way these lawsuits are framed, that you've talked patients into false memories. And there is a direct correlation between the literature on police interrogation and the allegations against therapists in this area. All right, let's talk about informed consent. The notion of informed consent is relatively new in law. Although there were informed consent ideas earlier, it was the Nuremberg trials that finally generated the essential notion of informed consent. The law has always felt that an individual is autonomous and entitled to be the sole owner, possessor, and dealer of his or her mind and body. And anybody who seeks to tamper either with the mind or the body must get informed consent. Informed consent now should be used not only as a way of getting permission from patients, but also as a way of giving information to them. The risk disclosure cases that are mostly in the medical malpractice area have held doctors liable for failing to deliver information about risks that have only a 2% likelihood of occurring. And so the notion of informed consent is that the patient is entitled to know everything that he or she needs to know in order to make an informed choice. Now, in the informed consent area, the modern false memory argument or attack on therapist argument is that all of psychotherapy, at least on the analytical side, is experimental. And therefore, everything you're doing has not been validated by science. Part of what gives this argument its power is a 1993 decision by the United States Supreme Court called Daubert versus Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals Incorporated. You may have heard about it. The facts of the case have no relevance to us at this point, but what the Supreme Court said was that if expert testimony is going to be admitted into court, there are four criteria that must be met. First, whether the theory or technique has been tested or can be tested. This is a principle of verifiability. Whether the theory or technique has been subjected to peer review and or publication. Whether the theory or technique has a known or potential error rate. And finally, whether the theory or technique is generally accepted within the relevant scientific community. It is my belief that you can meet all of those criteria, but in order to do so, it is necessary to do longitudinal studies on the effectiveness of various forms of psychotherapy. And it is necessary to show that the methods and techniques that you use are indeed curative and have low potential error rates. The more scientific studies you have on your side, the less vulnerable to legal action you will be. And therefore, what is needed at this time is for the profession itself to stand up and convert art into science and make sure that the kind of studies that the Supreme Court is going to insist on are available and delivered. And those studies then have to be disseminated across the profession itself. Now, while we're talking about the profession itself, it is my view, and I'm sad to say it, but I don't feel that it is inaccurate, that the major professional organizations have let you down, and their insurance carriers have let you down. In this moment of your greatest need, they have issued the greatest silence. If the literature shows that repressed memory in 37 studies is a concept that can be validated, where are the professional organizations making that point? Where are they in the court cases? It is necessary for, if the APAs and the AMAs are not going to speak, or even worse, are going to speak with a wishy-washy voice, then the public can only hear one side. This is like the story in law of the guy who was called to grand jury duty, and he didn't want to do it. The grand jury is a body of citizens that is convened to hear the prosecution's case. And if the prosecutor has enough evidence, the grand jury will indict. It's only the prosecutor's case that they hear, and only for the decision of whether there's enough evidence to indict. So this man went to the judge and said, I don't want to sit as a grand juror. And the judge said, why? The man said, well, I only can hear out of one ear. And the judge said, well, you're only going to hear one side of the case, so you're going to sit. Well, the public has only heard one side of the case. And for organizations such as your own that are most directly threatened, you should have a media campaign. All of you can go home and write letters to your local newspapers. You are vast in your numbers and in the regions that you serve. And writing a letter about the true science of these issues and countering the media barrage from the other side is essential in this day and age. And so not only is it necessary for organizations most directly threatened to take affirmative action in the outside world presenting your viewpoints, but you should work inside the bigger organizations to galvanize them to action and to stop their silence from being just one side of the story. Now, my time is short. There's always so much more to say, but I don't want to be pessimistic about this. In the short run, it seems to me, things look quite despairing. Headline after headline, acts as Chinese water torture. One drop at a time wears a hole in your head. But in the long run, I have to think of this the way we think of the Soviet Union under Stalin, where what was politically correct was scientifically accurate. And the biology and the psychiatry in the Soviet Union for 30 to 40 years wound up being an adulation of Marxist political theory. And when that was finally thrown off, scientists could get back to the good work that they necessarily need to do. I think we're experiencing the same kind of thing in this area right now. And I want to close with a remark of Arthur Schopenhauer, which it seems to me fits the current occasion. Schopenhauer said, all truth passes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. And third, it is accepted as being self-evident. Now that we're in stage two, can stage three be far behind? Thank you.
We've been listening to a presentation by Professor Alan Shefflin, professor of law at Santa Clara University in California, and this comes in the wake of the U.S. government attempting to bring criminal charges against psychotherapy and indeed, in effect, criminalizing psychotherapy. And this is one of the prime resources available for victims of sexual abuse, sadistic abuse, and mind control. And I can't help but asking, you know, what is behind this? Why is the U.S. government trying to criminalize these resources? What is the motivation for their actions? Is it that they're worried that victims of U.S. government mind control and organized child pornography and prostitution are healing and talking about their experiences, exposing the U.S. government's role in these atrocities? I think it's a question worth asking. You've been listening to The International Connection on CKLN 88.1, and we're continuing with our radio series on mind control.